this episode, I'm talking to my friend Javier McKay, Mackie. Sorry, man, I'm messing up your name again like I always do, but he was a Green Beret. He's retired now, Special Forces guy. He does some training and some of that kind of stuff here on the civilian side, but he's still working to try to get some people out of Afghanistan, people that meant a lot to him. So we talk about Afghanistan a lot in this. We talk about the withdrawal process, maybe what could have been done better, but mostly about what it's like to be in Afghanistan and what it's like to be a civilian, a retired guy, working to get your dudes out of a country after your government gave up on them. Yeah, it's crazy. Hope you guys enjoy this episode as much as I did. Thank you. I'm here with Javier Mackie. I already think I might have blew it. Is it okay to use your name?
Yeah, that's cool.
I should have asked you that while we were talking before.
No, dude, I don't care, man. They can Google search my name. There's nothing classified or
okay.
I'm not involved in anything too big. So
okay, so I'm here with my buddy Javier Mackie, and you know, we wanted, actually a bunch of people reached out and said you should have him on your show, and I was like, well, it's cool because we've been talking about doing this for, gosh, I don't know, months at this point.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, well, this would be the perfect time. We've got this Afghanistan stuff going on, drawdown. And I know that you're heavily involved. Well, you're involved in parts of things with even the drawdown now. And for, cause no one know. Okay. A lot of listeners are not going to know who you are, obviously, especially not the way I do or whatever. So can you just give us like a quick rundown of your military service and you know, your relationship to Afghanistan and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so I was a special forces soldier. I joined after I went to selection after 9/11, completed a Q course sometime after that, did my first deployment to Jordan, which was like a FID mission, which is for FID stands for Foreign Internal Defense. Basically, we go to another country, and while we're there, we basically train with their special forces and get some cross cultural understanding of who they are and what they represent in the world. After that, I served in Afghanistan from 2006. To 2009 or 2010 consecutive, like back-to-back deployments. And then I had a not so much a break, but I served elsewhere in Central Asia for 2 years, and then I came back back to Afghanistan 2013, 14, 15, after which I went to I took a position at the University of Central Florida as a instructor for military science, teaching ROTC student cadets so that they can become officers. So that's that. That's the nutshell of it. Afghanistan, you know, because I spent so much time in Afghanistan, I was like a total of 7 deployments. We did a lot of work with the Afghans, by, with, and through. Basically, we trained them. After we trained them, we took them out on missions, and they were the face of the mission. So whenever it was, whenever we encountered locals in a village, it was the Afghan government's face on the engagement. And we were just there to facilitate and the best thing to say, we were there to represent the interests of the United States when it came to stabilizing and securing the government.
Yeah, and all those are special forces deployments, right?
Right. Every single one is. I've never did anything on the conventional side outside of the United States.
And so right now, we were talking before we jumped on about, well, we were talking about a whole bunch of stuff, but you're talking about how you're working with, you're trying to get folks out that were interpreters for you, and some of like dealing with the like the real human side of the drawdown stuff. And I mean, what I mean, you know, I don't want to be the sports sideline reporter and be like, well, how does that feel? You know, but I mean, like, how is it logistically, how big, like, what does it feel like on this end? And when I say feel, what is it like working with, I don't mean feel. I mean, what is it like working with people trying to get them out of Afghanistan right now? Like people that matter, like people that really matter.
So is like, I can go back to like 2006, you know, my first deployment in Afghanistan. And, you know, being kind of wet behind the ears and not really knowing what to expect. When I got on the ground, the locals there were very welcoming to having U.S. forces there. They were, you know, people were working. People were they didn't have to worry about the certain types of restrictions that are in place by Sharia law. And Afghanistan, in my eyes, was a very living entity in and of itself. It much, you know, regardless of they didn't have everything that we had here in the United States, obviously, but they had what they were accustomed to, and they were looking forward to a better future with the Americans being present, helping establish a new Afghan government. And we weren't there to colonize, or, you know, I didn't feel like we were there to colonize. I kind of felt like we were there on a just cause of finding Osama bin Laden, making it a safe haven for Al-Qaeda terrorists. And so with that, we forged some really strong relationships. And the relationships we formed was primarily through our interpreters, because our interpreters were our voice to the Afghan people. And they were the means by which we communicated to and through the Afghan representatives that were representing the overall Afghan government. And so they played a really key and integral part in everything in our everyday lives. Like, for instance, one of my interpreters was they all had different functions. You know, one of my interpreters was my foreman, and he spoke very good English, you know, fluent English. And, you know, I wouldn't say like fluent in the sense that he understood all the accents of American language, but he understood enough to convey what our intent was being there. And so with that being said, you know, I put him in charge of, you know, hiring locals to come on base, and after which we would then vet, and those workers would, you know, wash our laundry, cook our food, help with the repairs and maintenance on our vehicles. We had a number of Russian weapons that we acquired during that time period. And so we had Afghan gunsmiths that understood Russian weapons, and they can get them functioning. And so we had a number of different things that we actually had them to do. But outside of that, we had, you know, outside of that one foreman, we had other interpreters that went out on missions with us. They carried guns, they wore body armor, they fought alongside us, and they also helped rally the Afghan border police or the Afghan National Army, the ANA, or other entities that were helping us establish security in the area. When we got into firefights, you know, they were able to, we would communicate to them, hey, we're going to flank, you know, we're going to maneuver on these, on the Taliban that are fighting us, or, you know, at the time, the Haqqani or HIG, whatever the anti-Afghan, Afghan militias that were, you know, out there to disrupt our Afghan, pro-Afghan government operations. And so with that came a lot of confidence that we built with them. Also, came a lot of confidence in the people that we were training, because these Afghan interpreters were there for every bit of the training that we put the Afghan soldiers, police, whoever we were working with through. So they understood, not only were they getting trained, but they were also conveying what our instructions were to the Afghans that were working alongside us, so that we can actually do our job while we were there. And it was a really nice relationship. And with that became, not just a relationship of like, they were no longer acquaintances. They were brothers in battle. They were guys that we can entrust with a task to go out and do, and without us being there and know exactly what our intent was, so that whatever we tasked them with was actually accomplished. So, you develop a really intimate relationship with these guys. And over the years, 2006, 2007, my first two deployments in Afghanistan were in the same area. So I just didn't, go there in 2006, go back home, redeploy somewhere else. No, I came back to the same fire base, knew the same people, knew the same villagers, and they knew my face. They even gave me a name. They call me Black Mountain, because I'm just, I'm black and I'm a big dude. And so that was the name that they gave me. And when I rolled through any of the villages in our area, the chief of police asked, "Hey, Tor, how's your family doing? Tora, how's your family doing? Hey, Black." And I didn't take any offense to it, because it was a term of endearment. And it was kind of, those guys who gave me that name, they had gone through firefights with me, so they knew who I was. They knew I had kids. They didn't know how many, but they knew I had kids. They knew I was married. They know I've been married for quite some time. We didn't divulge a lot of our information, but what information they knew from what they heard in conversations and whatever, or rumors, is what we kind of ran with. And so when it came time to the withdrawal from Afghanistan, a lot of these guys called out to us, and not just the guys in 2000 that I worked with in 2006 and 2007, but 2008, 2009, 2010, I have about five or six interpreters that reached out to me, and it's like, "Hey, we need help with our visas, our paperwork, to get to the States or get elsewhere." And and so since the drawdown, I've been quite busy doing some of the administrative duties. Not so much, I haven't had any success doing any of the being able to get them through the whole process and get them on planes, but I have been able to help them out with the administrative portions of getting them getting their paperwork squared away, so that when a time comes, they get the phone call or the email, whatever, however they're being contacted, they can report to the appropriate place to be extracted out of Afghanistan.
So in some sense, these guys maybe they're not quite fully teammates, but they're pretty close. And because obviously here you are in the States, you've got, and I, obviously we know each other personally, and so I know you've got a lot of things going on in your personal life, and I'm not saying like a bunch of bad things, but you've got a lot going on. You're a guy and a dad and all this, you got a lot going on, and you're volunteering time to try to get these guys out. I mean, that's a lot more than some other people would be willing to do. And I would think that is probably because there's a real relationship there, you know, right. An actual relationship.
Yeah. You know, like I said, these guys, when we were in Afghanistan, anything we needed, like say for instance, anything from clothing to gifts for a family, or, you know, it went more than just, hey, I'm deployed and you're just a guy I'm working with. It was, you know, I actually knew the names of their kids. I actually, you know, when a teammate of mine died in 2008, the locals went out of their way to make sure that the family received gifts from the people of the village in solidarity. You know, there's a lot of solidarity. So they were teammates, you know, there was the interpreters themselves. Now the Afghan police, the border patrol, the Afghan army guys, and in some cases, some rarely rare cases, and most of the commandos that we worked with, we didn't have that type of relationship. It was hey, I'm here to train you. I'm here to go out and fight with you. And that's it, you know, and because we weren't, at the end of the day, once that mission was done, they were going home to their family. I was returning to the firebase, and the interpreters were the guys that we sat down in the chow hall and ate dinner with. They're the ones who, when they would go out, they would bring back gifts to us, or we would bring gifts from the United States. Hey, you know, hey, Hoff, can you bring me back some jeans, or can you bring me something that's kind of unique to where you live in the United States? And, you know, my wife and I, we would put together little packages to send out to those guys so that they had them. And not only did we have the local interpreters, but we also had U.S. Afghan interpreters, guys who were actually citizens of the United States of America, who were serving there in Afghanistan as interpreters which really cleared up a lot of confusion. So like, you know, in American jargon, we say things like, especially in America, in the military, we were very crude. Like we would say, hey, this guy's a good mother effer, you know? Mm-hmm. And, to us, that's a compliment. That's one of the highest compliments. You know that, right? But to them, in the beginning, I remember saying it to a new worker, because I really liked him. I'm like, hey, this guy's a good, real good mother effer. And he understood that. He didn't understand English, but he understood what I said. You know, and he took offense to it. And so interpreters was there like, hey, bro, you know, for the U.S. military, for them to say that, it's a high compliment. It's not something that they would say to insult you, and don't, it's just something to say. It has no meaning. And so at the end of the day, I learned something, and as well as hopefully the worker learned something that, you know, some of the things we say, we really don't mean, but we say it's meant to be something that's held in high regard. And there's very few instances in our relationship with the Afghans where one of the guys on my team, someone I've worked with, said something that was very, you know, that they didn't understand that they understood not to be offensive. Now, some guys, and I think this, I'm not trying to justify green on blue, where an Afghan, you know, where Afghan that's friendly to U.S. forces turns on an American. But I think in some of those cases, I think most cases, those people who turn, when you have a green on blue instance, they have been compromised. But I think there's a couple cases of friends of mine who fell victim to green on blue, who might have said a few things that they didn't have the relationship built with the local national, and they took offense and felt like it was necessary to escalate their honor by, you know, making it a more catastrophic event.
That's interesting. I've never heard that perspective, but I can totally see how that could happen.
Oh yeah. I know one guy in particular who was a very aggressive guy, and he was aggressive in his speech, but he wasn't necessarily aggressive in his manner. And so I know that he might have said something that I'm not saying, like, again, I'm not trying to justify a green on blue in any circumstance.
I hear what you're saying.
But if I had to go back in time, and if I wasn't there, you know, in any of these events that happened, I was never there. But I can imagine, just because of the temperament of the guy, what might have happened and how that might have went down because of that. If only if the Afghan had not been compromised.
Sure. So how would you say I got a lot of things, but when you went into Afghanistan, you were looking for bin Laden and all that, especially as an SF guy. You're an 18 Bravo guy. I mean, you're a hard charging dude. You go into Afghanistan, you're looking for bin Laden. You know, the mission seems pretty clear. And then eventually it becomes obvious that maybe that's not really what the mission is. And now you got a new mission. That's a different discussion, but now you have a new mission. And you're making friends with locals, and you're doing your best and all this. And obviously you guys were actually making friends, because, you know, you referenced, I assume, Sergeant First Class Miller getting killed, and, you know, the gifts that were, you know, that these people went out and got gifts for this guy who had sacrificed heroically. Y'all did. Every one of you did, as far as I'm concerned, in that, you know, in that firefight and exchange and stuff. So you went in looking for bin Laden, then you started trying to take care of people because that's just the kind of guy you are. But now when you look back at it, how much of this looks different in retrospect? Like, has your opinion on Afghanistan changed? Obviously not your opinion on Afghanistan. How much is your opinion on what we did or what you guys did in Afghanistan changed?
Well, yeah, that's a very, very, man, we can go down some lot of rabbit holes, but just in that question alone, because I understand where you're coming from. So we went there, my first couple tours there, we had no clue. We weren't getting fed any information as to where bin Laden was. So in retrospect, we weren't technically working, you know, we weren't technically looking for Osama bin Laden per se. However, if something came up on our radar, and it was very likely, because where I served at in the Kunar province, we're right there on the Afghan-Pakistan border. So the likelihood of us getting any information on Osama bin Laden or UBL there was a likely chance of that actually happening. There were rumors, like, for instance, there were rumors as to houses, because there were, you know, in Afghanistan, people live in poverty, and every kalat or compound, we call them, the Afghans call them kalats, we call them compounds, but every kalat didn't.
So I don't mean to cut you off. Is a kalat like a tiny village or something? Is that?
No, a kalat is like is their compound. So for the sake of description, let me describe. So you have a village. A village is going to be made up of many kalats. And the kalat will consist of four walls. And within those four walls will be a courtyard. and attached to the wall, to at least three of the walls, at the very minimum, will be a structure where, you know, the members of the household will sleep, eat, cook, and store livestock. And so so it's just like it's like our own little house with a fence around it. But in the case of a clot, there have these about a half meter thick wall that goes as high as, I don't know, 10, 15 feet. And with anything that happens within that wall, those walls, you can't see from ground level. And there's usually one or two entry points, which is like either a gate for a vehicle to go in and out of. And that within that gate itself will be a built-in door. So the gate serves two purposes, to let in larger vehicles, or the gate will serve a purpose of letting one individual in. And from that, they can secure it from the inside. So these walls are usually thick, and the clot is usually surrounded by farmland. And in some cases, what will happen, these clots will be a part of a bigger family. So that one clot may have, two to three families, but then, you know, a son will get married and his wife will move in, and over a period of time, they will attach an extension to that clot and make that so that one clot will become two, but it'll still be called one clot, if that makes any sense.
It does. Yeah, it does.
And then within the village itself, you'll have depending on the blend of the family, they can be very big and they can be very small. In most cases, they're fairly, they're about the same size as a family, as a lot in a major city. Like for instance, I live in Orlando, and, probably definitely less than an acre, that the structure itself will be on, but, their total property may be a couple acres, 2 to 3, 4 acres, you never know. And then the Afghans themselves have developed a system of, that's another thing, where the Afghans themselves will develop markers as to which, you live out in the country. So, farmers know what their property is, and mm-hmm. they're no different than anybody else. They know their property better than anybody else. So, that's the kind of like the family structure, going along the lines of the families. So within that, the people are very most people there are very, hey, I just want to live my life. I want to have as many wives as Sharia law allows.
Who doesn't want that?
Yeah. I mean, this, like, I would say 90%, 95% of the population in Afghanistan just want to just be left alone, like anywhere else.
Sure.
But they do want structure, and they recognize structure when they see it, and they will go along with whatever structure, power structure is available. And they will do that in as long as everybody's in agreement to how that structure is ran. And so I would say that the average Afghan really has no loyalties to any government entity other than what's described in Islamic law. I could be wrong on that, but that's just what I saw in perception. But the overall, their reception of us, I've never seen a lot of, I never really witnessed like open hostility towards Americans, outside of getting shot at by those who are against the government, obviously, but for the most part, it was the people there were just, hey, I just want to live my life. I want to feed my family. I want to grow my crops. Leave me alone. On Friday, I want to go to the mosque. And any opportunity to earn money, they're going to take that opportunity. And within the structure, you know, just from my perception, within this cultural construct, you know, the local leaders had to show strength. And so we can sit in a shura, which is a meeting with the local elders, and we can come to an agreement as to how things are going to go henceforth. But when they walk out of that building and they address their people, they're going to show their authority and tell the people that they demanded so many things from the Americans, and the Americans acquiesced to their demands so that they maintain the confidence of the Afghan people. And so we had to allow that to happen on a lot of levels. You know, we had to, you know, and it was explained, like, you know, a lot of the leaders, the provincial governors, were people who actually were living in America, went back to the to Afghanistan to run a province, you know, as a governor, and they understood how Americans, they understood the American attitudes, they understood American the way we do things, but at the same time, they also understood their own people. So going back to what I said before, you know, they'll be very cordial and very, and it will demand things. And when I say demand, you know, it was like, hey, it wasn't like, hey, we will have this and you will give that. No, they would just ask. When I say demand, they would ask of the request. But when they went out to the people, it was very different. You know, they were, hey, you know, and we knew this. I didn't know this at first. And I was like, you know, WTF, you know, why is this guy shit? You know, why are we eating with this guy and drinking tea and laughing? And in the moment that's all done, he goes out the door and he's given the middle finger, the Afghan equivalent of the middle finger to the Americans. And all it was a game, some gamesmanship, so that if any Taliban were actually there intermixed within the village, they would report back that, you know, whatever they would report to, you know, the Taliban leadership of what's going on in our area. I don't even know if I answered your question, dude.
That's all right. That was actually better than a direct answer to the question, because so much of us don't, including myself, don't know a lot about the Afghan culture. And every once in a while I see similarities to Iraq and what you're talking about. And then, you know, some of it is like very different. It's pretty obvious that, you know.
Yeah, they're very interesting people. You know, like I said, they will, whoever has the most power is the people that, you know, I'm not to say that, you know, they're turncoats or anything like that. It's just, you know, they're very good at reading the environment, the shifts, the wind, you know, how the environment shifts, and the leaders that are in place know how to communicate the thoughts and attitudes of the locals to with regards to how they interact with us.
Yeah, it's funny, in this way it sounds a lot more like the Native American, especially in the West, sounds a lot more like the way things went between the Dragoons and then later the U.S. Army and this kind of stuff out here on the, you know, the high plains in that area. Sounds like a lot of similarities, and at least in the way that sort of that those contacts went, you know, each time.
You know, it's funny you say that, because when we go through our training, the Robin Sage scenario is, it's a total unconventional war scenario, But a lot of it has to do with the politics of interacting with the key leaders that as the government starts to change, the U.S. forces have to engage with the local, the new local leadership, right? And as that, to establish governance. And so what we call is like putting the Afghan face or putting a local national face on a new policy. And the whole point of it is really not to, for U.S. to say, hey, this is what the U.S. wants. We're more or less facilitators. In the Robin Sage scenario that we go through the in the Special Forces qualification course, really hammers a lot on that within built-in scenarios. And I saw that a lot as an ROTC instructor. I led a lane with my lane, the lane, a training lane I led was a key leader engagement. And that's where, you know, Army leadership, mostly, you know, mainly an officer engages with the local populace, you know, with the intent of the Afghan government and the U.S. in conjunction with the U.S. government's intent. And they engage the local the local leaders in helping the local leaders facilitate governance in a remote region. And it's really hard because you have centers of gravities, like a center of gravity would be a big city, right? Like Kabul will be considered a center of gravity because it's a big city. People will gravitate to there for commerce, will gravitate to Kabul for news, what have you. Mazar-e-Sharif up north is another hub. Herat is another center of gravity. Kandahar, another center of gravity. And then you have smaller centers of gravity around that naturally develop around fire bases or FOBs, where you have a large population of, you know, local nationals who live in a certain area, start to start to move into the area because there's jobs available provided by the coalition forces. So with these, all these little centers of gravity, you have an opportunity to engage the populace in bigger masses. So what the biggest challenge in Afghanistan was these small villages that were so far removed, they didn't have access to a main supply route. We Americans will call it a main supply route. To the civilian world, it would be just a road, a major road, whether it be improved.
Like a freeway.
Like a freeway, yeah. And, you know, those are means of communication and delivering of goods and services. And so so if you have a village that's 3 to 4K, we engaged, like we went to villages in Afghanistan, like where I was the first person, first non-Afghan they would see and ask whether or not if I'm Russian, because they had no clue.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah, you know, like, and here I am, a big black dude. Do I look like a Russian? You know,
do I look like I fought Rocky in that movie? Do I look like that guy to you? I'm from Rocky One.
I lost to the Russian, yeah. But
yeah, I'm the guy that beat his ass in the first one.
But yeah, you know, we walked into a village. There's one village that was like 5 or 6 kilometers off the main road in Kunar. Mm-hmm. And the only people that left the village were the elders to go get foods and supplies for the village. And because the village was self-sustained, you know, they had water, they had plenty of food, you know, they had a local market 5 or 6 kilometers away, and there was no sense, and it was like maybe 5 or 6 families. So when my big black butt walk up into their village, you know, and there's no one around, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. And then, you know, I see one local and you know, I have a Terp next to me and they're like, hey, are these the Russians? And we're like, no, these are Americans. And then they all come out, you know, they come out of the woodworks.
Wow.
And it, in the terrain really restricts some of those villages from actually getting communication, whether it be, you know, cause we think of communication as, you know, verbal. In this sense, I'm talking all senses of the, of forms of communication. You have news, radio, you have, so you have the media, word of mouth, which is the most common in some of these places. You have ICOM radios, which are handheld ham radios, essentially. In the United States, they would be considered ham radios.
Kind of souped up walkie-talkie for someone who's not in. You know,
And that's in fact, you know, before cell phones became a big thing, before cell service became a big thing in Afghanistan, that's how everybody communicated, was through ICOM.
Wow.
And, you know, they had coded messages. You had another form of communication was flashlight at night. You know, when they didn't want to communicate over the radio, they would, you know, across the valley, they would, you know, have their form of Morse code that they will signal one another, you know, across the valley to talk. You had, I said, word of mouth. Newspapers weren't a big thing. So a lot of times the news, that any type of communication that the village received, any type of information from the outside world, that a particular village that's far removed would receive, would be received through word of mouth or over the ICOM. And wow. So those are some of the challenges that not only that we face, but also the Afghan government faced for these smaller villages outside of these larger cities, because in these larger cities, everybody knew what was going on. The lines of communication were plenty, whether it be news, school is another line of communication out to the outside world.
Sure.
Doctors, guys who they had guys who ventured. Each province had two to eight guys that would venture throughout the province, giving vaccines out. And with that came news of what's going on elsewhere throughout the country. Mm-hmm. Family members was another, you know, another means of communication. You know, a daughter may be married off to another family who then relocates to another area, and then she comes back to visit her family, and whatever news she brings with her is also a form of communication. So it's very simple, but also rather complicated in the world that we live in, with you know, smartphones and television that we take for granted.
Yeah, I mean, it's not fair when people say, you know, Bronze Age and this kind of stuff, but you know, when they compare Afghanistan to that era, but you know, I understand where that's coming from, or Stone Age, even, you hear that one.
Yeah.
I understand where that's coming from, but it really, honestly, you know, as a layperson who never went to Afghanistan, a lot of this sounds so familiar. You know, obviously I read a lot about the old West in the American sense, you know, out here where I'm from, I read a lot about that history, and this sounds so much, it sounds so similar to what was happening with the first patrols that were coming out here. It sounds so similar.
Yeah. You know, like the movie Dances with Wolves. I don't know how you feel about that. But
you don't want to know how I feel about that. No, I'm just kidding.
But you know, I watched that about 6 months ago, and it reminded me a lot of being in Afghanistan, you know. It was very, in a lot of cases, it was very similar, except for, you know, meeting a squaw that was a kidnapped squaw, you know.
Yeah, you never got yourself a squaw out of the deal. Did you get you one of those porcupine quill vests or anything cool like that?
I have a couple outfits that were gifted to me during the time of Eid. So they're Eid, like we have Christmas every December 25th. So they have a small Eid and a big Eid, and I'm not really dialed in as to the meaning of either, but the big Eid my first tour in Afghanistan fell in the Christmas time frame, and so naturally, when I returned the following year, I thought, oh, shoot, they celebrated it, so I'm going to bring them some gifts. So I brought them some dates and some things that, you know, I found out that they really liked. And so I brought a bunch of stuff from the States. Okay. And come to find out, it had the time frame changed. So it didn't fall on Christmas.
So it's like Ramadan. It's landing at different
Ramadan
times.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it was Ramadan. It's the same thing.
Oh, okay.
They call it Eid, and it's the same thing, the exact same thing. They take all their guidance from Saudi Arabia. So whenever Saudi Arabia says, hey, this is when we're celebrating it, that's when the rest of the Islamic world celebrates it, from what I gathered from the Afghans anyway. But yeah, it was a pretty big deal. And just the simple things like that made a huge impact on our relationships with the locals, and especially the people that the interpreters, because, you know, they saw that we took an active interest, and that wasn't something that most army units do, because, you know how it is, man. You're in a unit, you find out a year or two before that you're going to deploy, and so that's all, you know, you're all your focus is on deploying, but you don't really focus on, and correct me if I'm wrong, you don't focus on how you're deploying, you know, and what aspects that you have to really key on when you deploy, what some aspects that you may experience, because we had a lot of units who the year prior were in Iraq, and now they're in Afghanistan, and they're trying to fight a war that they fought in Iraq the same way in Afghanistan, and it doesn't work. You know, the people are totally different.
Sure.
So, so there's that aspect. A couple other aspects is I don't know what it was like for you in Iraq, but at least in Afghanistan, if the Afghans knew they can get something from you,
you know. These dudes were trying to sell me smoked carp and shit. Yeah, man, if they could get something from you, they would try to get it for sure.
They'd
like try to weasel you out of stuff, but.
Like, oh, here's a good example. Like when, so I did, like in 2002 to 2003, 2004-ish in Afghanistan, you can go and buy a huge carpet, a huge rug, and have a shimp sit like for $100.
Whoa.
Like nice Persian rugs, you know?
Whoa.
So by the time I left Afghanistan, what's that? The transportation secretary, Buttigieg?
Buttigieg. Buttigieg, I think. Is
yeah, whatever. That guy. So he sat in the carpet shop outside of my FOB at Bagram in 2013, 14. He sat outside in every day. He was trying to talk the carpet, the guy who sewed the rugs, down. I think
no
he
ended way.
Up Dude, I think he ended up paying a couple grand for like 90 square, like 100 square feet of carpet.
Oh my gosh.
Like he paid more money than I would ever pay for a carpet. And he thought he was getting a good deal.
that's why he's a transportation secretary.
Yeah. and so I would go into the, anytime I went into the market, because they were attached to our FOB, I would see him in there. I was like, and the guy who owned the shop, he was just like, dude, I'm not going down in price. Like I've already gone down enough for this guy, I'm not going down any. Because the Afghans figured out really fast that he's got, because I had teammates before I joined the team who bought thousands of dollars worth of, like, not just one carpet, you know, one rug. They bought 5, 6, 7 of these huge carpets or rugs and ended up coming back selling them for $2,000-$3,000 a piece.
Oh my gosh.
And this is like 2002, 2003 to 2005. And by the time I got there, they were going like 100-square-foot rug, which is pretty big.
Yeah.
Would go for close to $900.
Wow.
So I never bought anything from those guys. You know, if I got anything at all, it was either gifted to me, and I made sure that I gave them something in return for it.
It's very cool, man.
So, you know, I got a few trinkets, but nothing too extravagant. You know, it just, at most I got a lot of, like, all I wanted was clothes and the little hats that they wore. And that's about it. And, you know, just a few things for my daughters. But I never, like, and in return, I would always, if when I came back or when I left, I would ship out, you know, some stuff from the States, candy, clothes, whatever they had asked for. A lot of times it was cologne.
So really? Interesting.
Yeah. I would go to the dollar store and buy like $40 worth of cologne and ship it out to them.
That's very cool, man.
Yeah,
that's so very cool. Well, we're getting a little bit short of time, but I got a good mutual friend of ours, Lafayette Lee. He asked me, he wants to know how you feel like your faith impacted dealing with everything with you know, with all throughout all of this. How did your faith serve to help you cope, I guess is the right word.
All right. So I'm LDS. I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as the Mormons. And I served a 2-year mission. And I mentioned the reason why I mentioned that because of the faith thing. But I mentioned the mission because on my mission is where, you know, at 19 years old, I learned this selfless service, which happens to be one of the Army values. Selfless service was something that I really wanted to, at the end of the day, I didn't join the Army to kill people. I knew it was part of the job. Like, I don't think a cop joins wants to be a cop to kill people. You know, you wanted to serve their community. So I wanted to serve my country, but my approach of it wasn't, my approach wasn't, hey, I'm joining the Army just to kill people. I really wanted to serve. And I understood that there would be a time where that will happen. And unfortunately it did. And it's not something I try to brag or boast about, but, you know, it's something that I have to live with. But my faith really impacted the way I approached how I dealt with the Afghans that I worked with, because it was that pure love of Christ, that pure love of God that really, like, I took what they said at face value, and I used the gift of discernment, being able to discern what's going on. And I try to, you know, and so I try to really be as giving as I can to the people. I smiled a lot, you know, I joked around a lot with locals, you know, when it was appropriate. I took them seriously when they, you know, presented an issue, but I didn't at any point go there with an attitude of, hey, I'm better than you. You know, I wanted to learn as much about their culture as possible. I almost wanted to, like, go native, in, you know, in a sense of, I wanted to be that guy that understood their culture enough that when a problem presented itself, I understood what was going on. And because I served there for so many years, as time went on, I was able to do that in greater capacities every time, you know? And mm-hmm. so I knew I had a better understanding of where these guys would hide to fight us, you know, but at the same time, you know, when we would do a med cap, when we would go out to a village and provide medical assistance to the local doctors and physicians, we would, I would make sure I was part of the caregiving, even though it wasn't part of my job on a team, whether it be triaging patients as they came in to the clinics, or whether it be handing out something as simple as handing out humanitarian assistance. You know, I gave out a lot of humanitarian assistance, not just to my workers, but every payday. One of my responsibilities as a special forces engineer was I was in charge of all the workers. So I paid the workers, and I gave them, I tasked them out with duties around the firebase. But every payday, which was once a month, and depending on the worker, I would give them, you know, at least 300 pounds of food, whether it be rice, beans. I gave out a lot of feminine hygiene products because that was something that was drastically new. Tampons and maxi pads were a huge deal. And I had a Connex full of them. And these guys, the husbands will be like very discreet and be like, "Hey, Hav, can you hide this? Can you hide this stuff in the rice and the beans?" You know,
I'm like, not all that different than us, honestly.
Y'all, yeah. I remember, you know, the first week of marriage, my wife say, "Hey, go to the store and grab this for me." I'm like, "What the heck?" You know, I didn't know what to get. but yeah, it was a huge deal. And I would give them, you know, whatever they needed, clothing, especially for the kids, school supplies. And one of the big things was myself and another guy on my team, he's a Christian. Like myself, he spent a lot of time. This guy was awesome. He spent a lot of time teaching. We had orphans. We hired, I think it was 5 orphans. And one of the orphans, I'm actually helping getting his SIV paperwork. And that's what I spent the afternoon doing when we were texting back and forth. But we actually helped them learn English. And let me read you an email he sent me.
Yeah.
Just to put a human element on this conversation. I'm not going to say his name, but he sent me a email earlier today, and he says, "Dear respected sir, I have applied for SIV as per your recommended letter and forward all documents with the letter to the Civ Center. Respected sir, if you got any query regarding me from SIV, I need your strong recommendation because we are in great danger here." God. I'm reading this word for word. He says, "Please fill this form, my friend, and recommend me for P2 program 2. Looking at your kind response, fill this form and submit it to me. I am going to apply for instructions for U.S.-based media organization NGOs to submit referrals." So this kid couldn't speak. He could barely speak English. Wow. And this is an email he drafted. Yeah. We still got time. There's something else. Kind of give you an idea. I mean,
this dude writes better than most kids who graduate high school here.
Yeah. And this kid he's an orphan, and an orphan in the sense that his dad was killed by the Taliban before we invaded back in the day. Mm. My foreman that I was telling you about, we've been texting back and forth through through one of the chats that we use. And, dude, this is during a time when, the crowds the people were crowding the airport. He was saying things like, "Hey, my life is in danger." I'm trying to get him to leave where he's at to go to Kabul. And he's so afraid. He's like definitely afraid to even leave his house. After my team left the area, we picked no other special forces team was going back. He said his life was in danger. And so he moved to another city. And there he opened up a pharmaceutical shop. And that's what he's been working ever since we left. And when the biometrics system was compromised, I talked to him on the phone. He was crying. He was like, "Dude, I gave you you took my fingerprints, you have my name. You have all this information on me, and now the Taliban has it, and my life's in danger." And I had to talk him off the ledge, you know. I was like, "Hey, bro, I need you to act normal. If you bring any attention to yourself, you're gonna draw the wrong attention to yourself, and bad things will happen. I need you to open your shop." And because I was working with an American who's a retired officer who's living in Afghanistan, who has a family there, SF dude. And I put him in contact and I was like, "Hey, you need to contact this guy. He will get you, he'll start making arrangements to get you to Kabul." But that all fell through, with the bombing and everything, that just shut everything down. And so this guy is just totally scared. He's locked down. He's been hiding in the shop. And it's just, it's such an emotional thing. So I've been keeping quiet amongst our group of guys that we communicate with, but it's been really hard on me because here I am hearing it in real time, things, I'm feeding him information. "Hey, this is what I just found out." And as I was finding out things, I was sharing it with you guys, and those same things I was sharing with him, and it just made things worse, And so at one point I was like, "Hey, you need to get up north. You need to get out of the country." And he's like, "I can't, the moment I leave my house, someone's going to die me out. And next thing you know, I might be dead." And I'm like, "Oh man." So the only thing that he's surviving on is his kids going out, his nieces and nephews going out to the market to buy food to bring back home. And fortunately, he was well paid, and he was a businessman before everything went down. So, he's got some funding that will last him quite a bit. As those families kind of pull their resources together, which makes life easier for them as a family unit. So, that's where my faith has really pointed me in a direction of helping these people without questioning it. But one of the things my faith has also taught me is to look ahead. And so now I'm thinking, once these guys do come to the States, they're going to need help, and they're going to probably call me to get help. Mm-hmm. Am I in a situation to be able to help them out? And so there's going to, that's a discussion I'm going to have with my wife, because I think we're going to have to sacrifice. We're going to have to sacrifice something to get, so that they can enjoy the freedoms that we only try to bring to their country. So,
well, let us know how we can help with that, because I want to help with that for sure.
Yeah.
All right, man, that's heavy. I don't want to leave on that. Tell me, I've been doing this new thing. I tried it with Julio the other day, but before we go, because we're out of time, but before we go, tell me what your favorite part of being an American is.
Man, the favorite part, my favorite part of being an American, and it hasn't occurred to me until maybe 10 years ago, is that I can be myself and not really care. No, it actually happened 20 years ago. No, I take that back. It happened in high school. I was the only black kid that liked Nirvana, that liked them, that liked and didn't care, and just didn't care because, you know, at that time you had to choose. You had to choose what type of music you liked, and it was expected that you went one way. And because I grew up in a musical background, playing in high school band and having, you know, family members who were musicians, I was open. I listened to the Beatles. I listened to Rolling Stones. I listened to rap, hip hop, you named it. I didn't care. I listened to Garth Brooks. If you got a ride with me in my car in high school, that, you know, you got friends in high places was playing on my radio, and I didn't care because it was good music. You know? So the part about being an American that I love the most is, you know, I learned at an early age from my stepdad that being an American is being an American, and it encompasses everything, not just one aspect.
I love that, brother. Thank you for coming on. We're going to have to do this again for sure. When it's,
dude, let's do it. Definitely.
Less heavy.
Yeah. I want to talk about Idaho.
Hey, we don't talk about Idaho on this podcast. We talk about Colorado.
All right. Yeah, that's where we want everybody to go.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Thanks, brother. I'm going to hit you up. Well, I'm going to talk to you after this, but we're going to do this again for sure.
All right, man.
Okay, thanks, bro.
I want to thank Cobb for coming on. He's a great guy. Go follow him on Twitter at Looking Over. His handle is like Looking Over Strange Terrain or something, but the at itself is Looking Over. Go check him out. He's a great guy. Super humble. Humble almost to a fault. I mean, the guy's an incredible warrior. In fact, he got shot twice in one firefight. I mean, he just has an incredible story. He's a really neat guy, and I can't wait to have him on again. Talk about some other stuff. If you like this show, please share it. We're going to try to really up the production value. I've got a buddy that's going to help me build an intro, and we're just going to try to level this thing up. And we have a few announcements coming up, especially on the, for those of you who've been following the veteran horse training, you know, try to get into the horse business thing. I've got a veteran coming up in November to start on that. So follow us for updates on that stuff. Follow me on Twitter at Braxton_McCoy. And I'll talk to you guys next week.